So today I'm going to say a little bit more about the Fisher matrix and then introduce the next topic I want to cover, which is Monte Carlo Markov chains. Before I forget, I'm going to have to cancel the lecture tomorrow since I have an all-day conflict. There will still be the tutorial. I won't be able to be there, but I think Basil won't be able to be there either, but Niyagesh Afshorty is going to fill in for the tutorial. So sorry about that. Let me say a few more things about the Fisher matrix. Last time I left, I sort of organized the lecture toward presenting the formulas that would be used in the problem set, and I skipped over a few things. So first let me write down the general definition for model space theta with data D. And almost everything you need to know about the Fisher matrix is contained directly or indirectly in the following two statements, that the Fisher matrix is additive in the sense that if I have independent data sets whose probability distributions depend on the model parameters theta, but D2 does not depend on D1 or vice versa, then the Fisher matrix is additive. Property number two is that under reparameterizations, in this situation where the model parameters theta, I construct a new model by making the model parameters theta functions of some new set of parameters theta prime. So that could describe either a reparameterization or a submodel of the original model. The Fisher matrix transforms the same way that the metric would in GR. In GR, the metric can either be reparameterized or pulled back through a general function. Like in GR, the metric can be pulled back to a submanifold. So I didn't actually prove this, so I want to give the proof, which is not trivial, and involves an interesting formula along the way. So as a lemma that I'm going to use to prove this, it's sort of useful to know that the Fisher matrix is given by the following alternate definition, at least in many references, this is given as the definition of the Fisher matrix. The two definitions are equivalent, and I decided to define the Fisher matrix this way since it turned out to be a little simpler to calculate the CMB Fisher matrix. I'm taking that as the definition. But there's this alternate definition that only involves first derivatives of the conditional likelihood. And I'll give the proofs that they're equivalent. So it's a priori, I think, non-obvious how we're going to get from this expression to, I forgot to write expectation value over D, how we're going to get from this expression to this expression. One thing to note up front is that the expectation value over D is really an integral over the space of realizations of the data weighted by the conditional likelihood and times whatever you're integrating. At least this would always be the case if the data were a continuous quantity. If the data were discrete, then the integral would just become a sum. If I take the strategy, if I start with the Fisher matrix the way that I defined it, Then I'm just going to use this identity to trade expectation values for integrals and then simplify. Then the proof is fairly mechanical. So I'll start in this first line. I've traded the expectation value for an integral over the conditional likelihood. And then if I actually evaluate this Hessian matrix and write the result in terms of derivatives of p rather than log p, then I can make the integrand like this. There are two terms. The first time I take a derivative, I get 1 over p times the derivative of p, and then when the second derivative operator acts, I get two terms, depending on whether it acts on the derivative of p and gives me a second derivative, or acts on the 1 over p. And, oh no. Didn't want that to happen, but that's fine. So let me just rewrite that line. Second term, if I rewrite the integral as an expectation value, is the, and write 1 over p times the derivative of p is the derivative of a log. The second term is the result that I want, the alternate definition. And so to finish the proof, I just need to show that the first term is 0. And to show that, I'll cancel these p's. And then I can bring these derivative operators to the outside. I can generally do that if I'm taking derivatives if I have an integral over one set of variables and derivatives with respect to some independent set of variables in the commute. And remember that the conditional likelihood is not an arbitrary function. For a fixed theta, it has to give a probability distribution in D, which implies that, in particular, that it's normalized correctly and integrates to 1. And so this first term, then, is then a derivative of 1 and just gives 0. So that's the proof. So as consequences of this result, one consequence is that the Fisher matrix really only depends on first derivatives of the likelihood function, not second derivatives. In a previous lecture, I had said that the Fisher matrix was kind of, and the specific example I had on the board was a CMB example with two parameters A and tau, that the Fisher matrix was kind of a local approximation to the to the true posterior, which because it only depends on the first and second derivatives of the likelihood function, can't capture the full nonlinear structure of the error regions, but is it usually a good approximation if things are well constrained. Anyway, that was slightly inaccurate because I said it depended on the second derivatives, and it really only depends on the first derivative. So you could think of the Fisher approximation as sort of like the first-order Taylor approximation to a function. If the only thing you know is first derivatives at a point, then it sort of represents the best possible approximation. It also explains, for example, the cancellation. When we computed the CMB Fisher matrix the second time through, We appeared to be getting terms that involved second derivatives of CL with respect to parameters. Those terms ended up canceling, as they would need to, since they we know the results should only depend on first derivatives of the likelihood function, and therefore first derivatives of CL. Anyway, this alternative definition is sometimes more convenient. For example, a little theorem we can prove is that the proof is straightforward if you have this lemma. It's always positive semi-definite. I.e., all of its eigenvalues are greater than or equal to 0. Just to be precise about the terminology, in linear algebra, a matrix is positive definite if its eigenvalues are strictly greater than 0, and semi-definite if the eigenvalues are greater than or equal to 0. We've sort of been implicitly assuming this all along, since if you're going to interpret the Fisher matrix as an inverse covariance matrix, then you'd better not have any negative eigenvalues. You are allowed to have zero eigenvalues in a Fisher matrix, and those just correspond to directions that are completely unconstrained, directions in parameter space where you have no sensitivity. If that's the situation, if there are zero eigenvalues in the Fisher matrix, then you won't actually be able to invert it to get a covariance matrix, since if you tried to invert, you would get an infinite eigenvalue, which makes sense, since the covariance matrix, the variance would be zero and infinite in the unconstrained direction. So for that reason, but the Fisher matrix may still be, with zero eigenvalues, may still be a useful intermediate quantity in a larger calculation. Like, maybe I'm going to use the additivity property to combine it with more Fisher matrices and get rid of the unconstrained directions. Anyway, to prove the theorem, so the proof is really straightforward. If you recall from linear algebra that F is positive semi-definite, if and only if a matrix vector product of the form V transpose FV is always greater than or equal to 0 for all vectors V. The equivalence, to see the equivalence between these two statements, you could just rotate to a basis where F is diagonal. Then it's sort of apparent that these two statements are equivalent. If I consider a matrix vector product of this form, then the non-negativity will be non-obvious if you use the original definition of the Fisher matrix. But if you use the alternate definition from the lemma, works out. If I write the Fisher matrix this way, then because VA and VB are constants, they can go inside the expectation value, and then you can recognize the result as the square the expectation value of a square, which implies that it has to be greater than or equal to 0. By the way, the proof also shows that zero eigenvalues of the Fisher matrix are in one-to-one correspondence with directions in parameter space VA, where the directional derivative of the likelihood function is identically zero. Those are unconstrained directions in parameter space, since if I move in that direction, I don't change the statistical distribution of the data. OK. So it's useful to have both definitions of the Fisher matrix and, you know, as another example, the proof of the transformation law. Sort of works out mechanically if you use the second definition. I'm sure you guys see what I mean, but let me just write it out. I want to prove the transformation law. Here's the primed Fisher matrix according to the second definition. And then if I'm reparameterizing this way, then if I want to differentiate with respect to theta prime, then by the chain rule, I could just differentiate with respect to theta and then put in the Jacobian. And then since these Jacobian factors are independent of the data D, they're constants for purposes of evaluating the expectation value and can be taken outside. And of course, what's left after I do that is the Fisher matrix in the unprimed coordinate system. Okay. So I really like the geometric perspective on the Fisher matrix, thinking of it as a metric. And so I want to do one more example of a situation where something becomes easy to think about if you're thinking of the Fisher matrix as a metric. And that is something called the Jeffries prior, which I had mistakenly called the Fisher prior in previous lecture. So to explain it, I want to say I realize that I've sort of implicitly been using some of these transformation laws without stating them formally. So just so everything's stated precisely, let me start by saying one thing I probably should have had in an early lecture on random variables but didn't is if I have, any probability distribution really on some space theta. In particular, I'm thinking of the case where the P is a Bayesian prior. How does it transform under a change of variables, theta to theta prime? A probability distribution is not a scalar under a change of variables. It transforms with a factor of the inverse Jacobian. But that is n. So this d to the n over d to the n is notation is supposed to be the Jacobian determinant. This is really part of the definition of a probability distribution is this transformation law under reparameterization. And this transformation law is because the probability distribution is supposed to have units of inverse volume. Or another way of thinking about it is that if I want to compute the expectation value of a scalar function, that is a function that transforms as a scalar under reparameterizations, then I want this integral to be reparameterization invariant. And this wouldn't be, this expectation value would not be if the prior P transformed as a scalar. then this expectation value, this integral, would not be independent of the coordinate system, since if I went to some primed coordinate system, this volume factor would pick up a factor of the Jacobian. But if I give the prior this transformation law, then the expectation value of a function is independent of the coordinate system in which it's computed, since the Jacobian and the dn theta cancels the inverse Jacobian and the p. So in particular, you know, in a previous lecture, the question came up as to whether there's like a natural prior or a uninformative prior is the terminology that the statisticians like to use. You know, in our examples, we had sort of been taking the uniform prior as a default choice. But due to this transformation law, and this looks like kind of a neutral choice, but due to this transformation law, you can see that it depends on the choice of coordinate system. A prior that's uniform in one coordinate system, if I make a coordinate transformation which is non-volume preserving, will not be the uniform prior in some primed coordinate system. It's not reparameterization invariant. So, the uniform prior is fine. You just should be aware that it depends on the coordinate system that you choose. Now, in the absence of any other mathematical structure on the model space, if I just have a, you know, a model space theta with no d attached to it or any sort of geometric structure, then there will be no way to build a reparameterization invariant prior. But if I have some experiment that I'm interested in forecasting, then I get more mathematical structure, and in particular, I get the, you know, the Fisher matrix, which I can think of as a metric. Once I get a metric, then there is a natural way to integrate functions. Namely, you know, if I want to take the expectation value of some function, then my GR experience would tell me that if I put the integral of d to the n theta times the square root of f, that I'll times some scalar quantity that I want to integrate, then I'll get a reparameterization invariant quantity. And that's sort of the geometric motivation behind the Jeffries prior, which is just to compute the Fisher matrix, take the square root of its determinant, and use that as the prior. And of course, that's easy to show, irrespective of the, you know, independently of this geometric picture, you can, using the transformation law for the Fisher matrix F, that involves two powers of the Jacobian, so two powers of the inverse Jacobian. So when I take the square root of the determinant, I'll get one power of the Jacobian determinant. Giving this, in other words, this will have the correct transformation law for a probability distribution. One way of thinking about this is the distance defined by the Fisher matrix is a notion of distance on the model space which corresponds to observational distinguishability. So if I have a model space and I imagine tiling it by points that are distance one apart, this would correspond to like a lattice of models that are distinguishable at one sigma. So the Jeffries, one way of thinking about the Jeffries prior is that the relative weight or likelihood that it assigns to two regions of model space just corresponds to counting the number of observationally distinguishable models that exist in each of those model spaces. So sort of like weighting different parts of the parameter space by the number of distinguishable models that they really contain.
Oh, sorry. I don't understand what you mean by invariant. Like, it does, the Jeffries prior should still transform, like, the probability distribution, right?
Oh, yeah, the check that I meant is that if you define P this way, then you can check that if I, under a coordinate transformation, the right-hand side does transform with an inverse power of the Jacobian. Uh-huh. Same is true for the square root G in GR. This transforms with the... inverse power of the Jacobian. So that when I write this down, it has the correct transformation law to be, if I define it this way in an arbitrary coordinate system, it has the correct transformation law to be a probability distribution. But the same would not be true for the uniform prime.
What if one of the eigenvalues of the Fisher matrix is zero? Like, determined in this case will be zero?
Oh, yeah, that is right. Yeah, I guess this definition wouldn't work if the Fisher matrix had zero eigenvalues.
So then, like, we check if it's if the determinant is non-zero, then we use this definition?
Yeah, that's a good point. This wouldn't really be a meaningful prior if the determinant were zero. Okay. That's all I have to say about the, so that's all I have to say about the Fisher matrix. I guess part of my point, and I presented the Fisher matrix in a lot of abstraction, and I guess part of the reason why I wanted to do that is that statistics sort of, if you look at like a Stats 101 book, statistics appears to be an extremely boring subject. But if you revisit the subject with more math tools, then I think it's like really kind of fun and interesting. Like, you get concepts from differential geometry are actually of practical usefulness when forecasting the results of experiments. That's really interesting. So I'm going to talk about, although the depth in which you use differential geometry, I would say, is not as great as GR. Like, I'm not aware of any practical data analysis context where it's useful to compute the curvature tensor from the Fisher matrix, for example. Although that would be a perfectly mathematically meaningful thing to do. Now I'm going to talk about so the Fisher matrix is just kind of an interesting mathematical machine that connects to differential geometry and the math of GR. Now I'm going to talk about another major topic that'll take a few lectures to explain. Which is really a much more interesting and deep mathematical machine, the Monte Carlo Markov chain. And it'll take a while. It'll take maybe a lecture or so before I can really fully explain the definition and sort of the way that it works. Whereas in the case of the Fisher matrix, we could just write down the definition from the beginning. But even just defining exactly what this is will take a little while. It's a much richer subject than the Fisher matrix. Like, I've sort of told you almost everything you would need to know to be like a professional Fisherologist if you wanted to go off and write cosmology papers where you did forecasts with the Fisher matrix. You really have all the sort of abstract machinery that you need, and it would help to see a few more examples with different likelihood functions that come up, but those would just sort of be a matter of filling in the details. But on the other hand, these Monte Carlo Markov chains can be really tricky, even finding ways of it's sort of like a toolkit of different techniques that you can try to apply in a particular problem, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. and extending the toolkit or coming up with new ideas for making these MCMCs work is still a subject of active research in both statistics and in cosmology. Okay, so I'm going to talk for a while about the basic problem that we're trying to solve. So imagine that switching gears from forecasting to data analysis. Let's imagine that we have a model space. And just to be specific, let's say that this is going to be the 6-parameter model space of the standard cosmological model. And we have some data, which is going to be some CMB map, which I'll take to be cosmic variance limited, meaning that these all of the ALMs have been observed perfectly up to some maximum multipole L max with no noise or other complications like a sky cut. And we know the conditional likelihood of the ALMs given some thetas. And just to write that likelihood down, in the cosmic variance limited case, we showed, discarding an overall constant, that the likelihood function looked like this, which is something you can compute, where the right-hand side is a function of the model parameters theta, because CL is a function of the thetas. So in order to compute this likelihood function, if I start with a set of thetas rather than a set of CLs, then operationally, to compute this likelihood function, what I would do is run camp. So I'm still thinking of the power spectrum CL is a function of the model parameters theta, and I'm still thinking of that function as being a black box implemented by camp. And then I would, once I have the CLs, and I also, now because I'm no longer forecasting, I have a realization of the ALMs, then I would plug into formula star to compute the conditional likelihood of getting my data ALM given a set of model parameters theta. So this is fairly non-trivial to compute. The slowest part is running CAM. Running CAM takes something like 1 CPU second. So just to keep an eye on the computational cost, the cost of evaluating this likelihood function at one point in the 6-parameter space is about a CPU second. Now, since I'm going to be talking about this function a lot, I'm actually going to abbreviate it and call it L of theta, L for likelihood. And at least if the prior were uniform, then Bayes' theorem would say that the posterior and the conditional likelihood are just proportional to each other. So I'm going to call that. These are really the same function up to an overall constant, which I won't keep track of. And I'll just refer to that function as the likelihood. In Bayesian analysis, once you've computed this posterior, and in this case, we would have some way of computing it that would take about 1 second per point per evaluation, then the next thing you want to do is to explore it. In order to see what parts of parameter space are allowed. And we haven't really talked about the best way. Explore has kind of been defined in a hand-waving way, and we haven't really talked about the best way to explore a likelihood function in practice. So let's think about some possibilities. So if I have a function of 6 variables, then the most straightforward thing to do would be to grid the likelihood. So you might do something like take for each of my six model parameters. You might sort of do an initial pass to figure out, like, say, the model that had the maximum likelihood. That would be the best fit model. And then roughly what parameter range is allowed around it. In order to set up like a grid. So maybe to, generally speaking, if I want to represent a function in two variables, say, then I might represent it on the computer as a 2D array, where I've defined some grid points on each of the axes, and then evaluated and stored the value of the function at each of those grid points. The number of grid points that you need will depend on the details of your function, how smooth it is, and so on. But just as a rough guess, let's say that let's say that you need about 20 points. And of course, that's 20 to the 6 points. Since if I want to grid a function of 6 variables, then I need to I have 20 choices of grid point for each of the 6 variables in the problem. So maybe that's what I mean by explore. That's one proposal anyway. I could grid this function on a big grid, and then I can compute whatever I want if I have a full representation of the posterior, and I can compute like expectation values and variances of any variable in the of any function of the thetas, for example. So the cost of doing that might be 20 to the 6 CPU seconds, which is about 2 CPU years. So this is really expensive. And the cost is exponential in the number of variables. In fact, 6 is too few for modern experiments, which typically have lots of nuisance parameters in addition to the cosmological parameters of interest. So in a real analysis, well, first off, a lot of the time you're extending the standard model. Like maybe you'd have a seventh parameter in there, like spatial curvature. And internally, if you're analyzing Planck data or something, to fully describe the power spectrum, you need a bunch of nuisance parameters that describe things like the dust contribution to the power spectrum and the parameters of the beam of the experiment and so on. And so then in a real experiment like Planck, the number of nuisance parameters might be of order 10. So you should imagine a case where you have, you know, something like 17 cosmological parameters here. And then gridding will never work. So we seem to be kind of swept this issue under the rug earlier when we were talking about Bayesian data analysis. I just sort of hand waved the last step where you interpret the likelihood function. But if you think about it, there's a huge computational problem here. This may be a function in a very high dimensional space, and it's just sort of unclear how you would ever sample or explore that function in a reasonable, using a reasonable number of evaluations of the likelihood function. So modern statistics has an answer to this question, and it says that you should do something called run, but gridding is not a good choice, although it will work fine if the number of variables in the model space is not too high. But in high dimensional spaces, and 6 parameters is already enough, then it's better to do something, instead, rather than gridding, it's better to do something called running an MCMC. And so to motivate the MCMC, so let me first say that the idea of the MCMC is that you're going to represent your likelihood function. Remember that the likelihood function is a positive quantity, and it's supposed to represent a probability distribution on the model space, which you can work with just like any other probability distribution. And so one idea in MCMC is that the best way to represent a probability distribution in a high number of variables is through just a sequence of random samples. So the best representation is not a grid, not a set of grid values, but a sequence of random samples. Theta A. Where the number of random samples might be of order 10 to the 5, say. And the reason that works, the reason that that's a better representation usually than the grid, is that usually we're interested in this high-dimensional likelihood function as an intermediate quantity, where we just want to integrate out all of the variables except for one to report statistical errors on a single parameter, say. So if you were analyzing a C&B experiment, then you might just want to report at the end what's the bottom line constraint on spatial curvature, say. And so what you're really interested in is the one-dimensional likelihood of parameter theta one, variable theta one, say, where I've just integrated out all of the variables of the n-dimensional likelihood except for the parameter of interest. And then what you would do is you would take that 1D likelihood and do, say, the procedure that we talked about for the biased coin, where you would integrate that likelihood up until you accumulated, say, 2.5% of the probability, and same on the other end. And quote this range as the 95% range on the parameter theta 1. Now, why is this integral the right thing to do? Why, if I'm interested in the statistical error on theta 1, why is the correct procedure to integrate the n-dimensional likelihood over the other parameters? Well, that's the correct procedure because in Bayesian statistics, you're supposed to interpret this likelihood function the same way that you would interpret any probability distribution. And so in general, if I have a probability distribution for a 2D random variable, say, then what that represents is the probability per unit x per unit y. And so if I'm just now interested in the probability distribution on x with the value of y just ignored or marginalized, then to get the probability, to get that 1D likelihood, probability per unit x, what I do is I just add up the probability for every y value at that x, and that just corresponds to integrating. And the same is true in any number of variables. You just formally integrate out the variables that you're not interested in to marginalize. If I have a so if this likelihood were represented by a grid, then in order to do this integral, I need to know all of its grid values, and that's an exponentially sized computation. But if this likelihood is represented by a sequence of random samples, if I have, say, 10 to the 5 samples representing this likelihood function, then if I just take those random samples and ignore their theta 2, theta 3s, and so on, to get a sequence of 1D samples, then that projected set of samples is a is sampling this 1D marginalized likelihood. A formal way of thinking about this that may be useful is that when I represent a high-dimensional likelihood by a sequence of samples, I can think of that as making an approximation where I approximate the likelihood function by a sum of delta functions, sum of n-dimensional delta functions. And if I integrate out all but one of the variables, then if I take this sum of delta functions and integrate out all but one of the variables, then of course I just get another sum of delta functions. Which tells me that if I just take the original set of samples and just keep the first component of each sample, that I get another set of samples of this 1D likelihood. And now would you, if you think about, so if you think about the result of data analysis as being like 95% constraints on every parameter in sight, then you can see that this number, 10 to the 5, is probably going to work, is going to be a good choice, regardless of the number of variables in the problem. Because if I have 10 to the 5 samples of a 1D likelihood function, then barring pathological examples, then in practice, I'll always be able to assign the 95% confidence interval pretty accurately just by taking, if I have a bunch of samples that live on this axis, then I just move this line in until it covers 2.5% of the samples. And that's a good approximation to the upper 95% limit and analogously in this sense. So if I just think about the size of the representation and not on the cost of computing it, then gridding a likelihood function is an exponentially sized representation, whereas a sequence of random samples has constant size as the dimension of the problem increases, which is really powerful. Now, what's not obvious is that how you would actually generate that sequence of samples. So what we have is a black box. For likelihood evaluation. And we can give a set of model parameters to, and it will spit out the value of the likelihood. And what we want is a black box that spits out samples. At first sight, it might seem that in order to draw random samples from the likelihood function, you would need to grid it or something, just to map it out in a high-dimensional space. And so it may not seem that this idea is really solving anything. But it turns out that there's sort of a big, the MCMC toolkit is sort of a bag of tricks for getting you from here to here. If I have some likelihood function or some probability distribution that I know how to evaluate pointwise, then you can try to use the MCMC toolkit to construct a black box or a machine that will output random samples from the distribution. I keep saying toolkit instead of algorithm, because there are a whole bunch of different algorithms that you can try to apply, and depending on how well-behaved your likelihood function is, they may or may not work, and you can sort of combine them and use different tools in the same problem that have names like the Metropolis algorithm is an extremely interesting algorithm that is usually the simplest possibility. Something called Gibbs sampling, something called Hamiltonian sampling. I may explain the ideas behind some of these algorithms later. And so on, in total, maybe 20 or so different algorithms that you can try to apply to a different likelihood function that hopefully will succeed in producing a sequence of random samples. You might notice that a lot of these algorithms have names from physics. And in fact, many of the MCMC algorithms are inspired somehow by statistical mechanics. They're trying to do something like construct some sort of random walk or interpret sampling the likelihood function as some sort of thermal process. In particular, there are statisticians. This algorithm, Hamiltonian sampling, involves like making up a fake Hamiltonian for your problem. And there are statisticians that are writing down Hamiltonians and integrating Hamilton's equations of motion as part of just ordinary data analysis for problems that have nothing to do with physics per se. So this is actually like a really mathematically interesting subject. The Metropolis algorithm is the first algorithm discovered, and it's very widely used. There was some survey of around the end of the in the early 2000s. There was some survey of computational scientists as to what the most important numerical algorithms of the 20th century were, and the Metropolis algorithm came in number two. Fast Fourier transform being number one, of course. This is a really big. There are cosmologists that are essentially professional practitioners of MCMC that just are really good at applying this toolkit to different problems. And the same is true in many other areas of physics and other areas of science, like even geology. This MCMC is sort of a very important unifying idea in statistics that cuts through like a lot of different fields at once. Almost out of time. The last sort of general comment that I want to make up front is that for well-behaved likelihoods. So I explained that the size of the representation, or the number of independent samples, at least for reasonably well-behaved likelihoods, is roughly independent of the size of the parameter of the dimension of the model space. Like a number like 10 to the 5 independent samples is usually a good goal. So for well-behaved likelihoods, it's frequently the case that the cost per sample, or the number of likelihood evaluations per sample, scales linearly with the number of per independent sample. In sort of an ideal, well-behaved case, you might expect this to go linearly with the number of parameters in the model space. At least if the MCMC toolkit is working well for your problem. Um, So you might think of the computational cost of gridding as being something like 20 to the n, where n is the dimension of the model space. And the cost of MCMC in a fairly well-behaved case as being something like 10 to the 5 times n. And so in low-dimensional model spaces, like if you only have two parameters, it's better to grid and not bother with MCMC. But as the number of parameters increases, MCMC is much better. It's linear. The cost is linear instead of exponential. And already in cosmology, where we're interested in usually seven or more parameters, MCMC is kind of the only, usually the only practical option. And it's like the default way that data is analyzed. In fact, the powerfulness of MCMC is a large part of the reason, in my opinion, why Bayesian statistics are usually preferred to frequentist statistics. It's just a really powerful tool that doesn't exist in the frequentist way of thinking about statistics. Okay. So I have to stop there because it's 12:30. And let me remind you that I do have to cancel the lecture tomorrow. So the next lecture will be on Wednesday. We'll still have the tutorial tomorrow. And so I'll have to stop there with some sort of semi-cryptic comments about MCMC. And on Wednesday, I'll start doing some math and telling you how it actually works.